And please welcome our panel of speakers. I'm going to give their names, and then we're going to listen to them one by one. Their names are Hilda is going to be our first speaker. Our second speaker is going to be Bob. Our third speaker is going to be Julia. And our fourth speaker is going to be Frank. And please, hands up for Hilda. She's going to speak up for us.
My name's Hilda. I'm an alcoholic. Hilda. It's so funny because I was, I have a sobriety date. It's the 20th of July, 1993. I have a sponsor who knows she's my sponsor. And I have a home group. And I think it's quite funny. You know, I was thinking about the New Orleans Gay and Lesbian Convention asked me to send them a talk or something, and then they called me back and said, you're really not gay enough for us. And North Dakota asked me to go speak, and they called me back and said, you're kind of too gay for North Dakota. So I'm not sure where I fall in there, you know what I mean? I just know I've been with my wife for 29 and a half years, and she definitely is gay enough. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you what kind of drunk I was. I used to drink in this part of... I was born in London, which will save you wondering. I forgot to say that once when I was talking in Oklahoma. And when they were thanking the speaker, this guy said to me, does everybody in Los Angeles speak like you? I said, yes. Yes, they do. So I was born in London, I grew up there, and I used to drink in this place called Bradford. I was in Harrogate. Bradford was a train ride away, and Bradford was rough and ready. And I used to drink in this lesbian bar there, and when I was drinking, I have a tendency to... thank you. I just started. You're stopping me already. I had a tendency when I was drinking to poke the bear, right? I would find out whatever you were passionate about and take the opposite opinion, even if I agreed with you. Just really obnoxious, pain in the arse. And I always had an American quarter with me because I'm really good at quarters. And I used to love teaching foreigners, our British compatriots, how to play quarters, you know. And I was in Bradford this time, and I was drunk, and this mountain of a woman, huge, was super passionate about politics. So I started poking the bear, because that's what I do, right? And I'm playing quarters with her, and getting drunk, and finally she'd had enough, and she stood up. And I stood up, because when I'm drinking, I think I'm 6 foot. And I'm looking up at her, and she just hauled back and broke my nose. And I looked up at her and said, does this mean you want to sleep with me? And she did. And you know, the next morning, of course, I want to chew my arm off to get out of bed. But I'm getting on the train back to Harrogate, right? Now I've got two black eyes. I've got dried blood down the front of me. I mean, I look like I've had a night, right? I'm sitting on the train, and there's a little old woman sitting across from me, and she's looking at me. And I just looked at her, and I was like, what? And you know that look, right? That's my drinking. It started out well. It never really finished well, you know what I mean? I'm a train wreck when I drink. I tend to, I got barred from a bar in Brussels, which was a gay and lesbian bar. It was an underground bar at the time. And I apparently got barred there when I was drinking. And when I was sober, I went back, not knowing I had been barred. And as I walked up to the door, the bouncer said, not today, Hilda. And I was like, but I'm sober now. He goes, I'm not sure that means you're not taking your clothes off. Oh. You can't come in, you know. And I have a tendency. So when I was drinking, I'd be in the States, and I'd get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I'd think, you know, England was better. And I'd move back to England, and I'd get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorder, indecent exposure, and I think, you know, America was so much better. And really, that's my drink, and it was always going to be better somewhere else. And of course, everywhere I went, there I was. And I have a long list of arrests for indecent exposure. And I know I don't look the type today. Well, maybe a little. But something happens when you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic. And I know I'm not alone in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've heard plenty of women share. But as soon as you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic, for whatever reason, I just know that you have to see my tits. Now, I tried everything for that not to be true. And I know that it's part of my alcoholism because I don't truly do not feel the need to show them to you now. But I was back and forth and back and forth, and you know, I'm a blackout drinker. I used to think when I blacked out, I had passed out quietly somewhere. And I found out that wasn't true, that when I had blacked out, you did not know that I didn't know that I wasn't there. You know, I saw myself on a video once. I was engaged 6 times, 5 rings. People just wanted to rescue me. But this one time, this guy called me and he asked me if I was ready to pick out rings, and I didn't know what he was talking about. And he brought over a video, and I was on the video, and it was all these different pubs we were in, and he was down on one knee, and I thought, dear God, say no. Because I wasn't there, and the reality was that he didn't know that I didn't know that I wasn't there. And that's when I figured out that when I was in blackout, I actually was functioning. I used to call it losing time. I was always losing time. I might lose a couple hours, a couple of days. It didn't matter. I was always losing time. And, you know, my drinking was just like that. I was never the, you know, have a good time and go home and not get in trouble kind of drunk. You know, I'm unpredictable, you know. I have a friend that used to say, you know, it doesn't, you have different types of friends when you're drinking, right? The ones who will bail you out, the ones who won't take your call, and the one that's sitting next to you in jail going, but it was a good time, right? I'm the it was a good time, right, kind of friend, you know what I mean? I first tried to get sober in 1989 on New Year's Eve. I picked New Year's Eve because I didn't think real alcoholics got sober on New Year's Eve. I know today only alcoholics mark a calendar. Non-alcoholics never think about their drinking. You know, like virgins don't go for pregnancy tests. I stayed sober for about 3.5 years. Well, I stayed dry for about 3.5 years. And I had this woman who was trying to sponsor me, and she got really ill and she was dying in hospital. And I went to see her one day and she said, just remember, Hilda, Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for you when you come back. And I hadn't drank yet. But she could see exactly where I was going. And of course, she pulled away. She passed away. I pulled away. And 7 meetings to 5 to 4, 3 to 2 a week, 2 a month. You know, and now I'm not going to Wednesday night because I can't stand the secretary. And I'm not going to Friday night because the same woman shares the same shite every week. And I can't listen to her anymore, you know. And I started taking AA's inventory. And the reality was I sat in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous dying of alcoholism. And I didn't know. And I drank for another 9 months. And I tell you what, I've heard people share at podiums that if you want to pick up where you left off, pick up a drink tomorrow. That's not my experience. When I started drinking after not drinking, my drinking was 10 times worse and more. You know, my blackouts were longer. The people I woke up next to were uglier. The beds were wetter. It was just bad. And the morning after what I hope is my last night before, it was the 20th of July, 1993, I woke up in my own bed, which had become a bonus. I was alone, which was a bigger bonus. And the bed was wet, and I'm still dressed from work, and all of this is my normal. But when I went into the bathroom, there was blood everywhere, and I had no clue what had happened the night before, and I had a moment. You know, I was thinking about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and the hideous four horsemen, you know, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I used to think, God, you're so dramatic. But that morning, I knew who they were, and my heart broke. Not because I can't drink. I drink with the best of them. But that morning, I realized that I had become unpredictable to me. I did not care when I was unpredictable to you. So I did the only thing I knew what to do. I called English-speaking AA because I was in Germany. And the fellow who answered the phone, Steve Baker is his name. He lets me break his anonymity. I told him my sad old story. You know, I'd been to AA, screwed it up, wine, wine, wine. And he said something to me I truly believe saved my life. He said, you know, Hilda, the most natural thing in the world for an alcoholic to do is drink. And that's why in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't shoot our wounded. And I believed him. It was the only reason I went to a meeting that night was because I thought he understood. And I went over to this meeting in Holmesbrook, Holland, and I was thinking about the meetings in Florida and California, really big meetings. And my plan was to sit in the back, get a little bit of time, and then tell you what happened. I walked in this room in Holmesbrook, Holland. There were 7 people in the room for an hour and a half. And nobody was letting me pass, you know, because I'm bloated, sweaty, I got a gash in my face, you know, they all look shiny and new. The vision for you over here, and you know, I ended up telling all of them, and you know, I got my sponsor that night because she was bullying me to take a commitment. She said, you know, you really need to make the tea and coffee. And I was like, this meeting was Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. This was Tuesday night. I was like, I didn't know if I'm going to be sober on Thursday. You know what I mean? She said, well, if you want to stay sober, you'll make the tea and coffee. Now, my head went, who is this psycho bitch, and why is she tormenting me? But my mouth went, oh, okay. And she was brilliant for me. She was like the service sponsor from hell, because she was on every committee. She did all these conferences. She was the chair of intergroup, you name it. And she would always ask me to drive her. So I drove her everywhere to all these things. And, of course, we'd go to a convention planning meeting, and they'd say, we need somebody to pick up the ashtrays, and she'd go, Hilda will do that. It's like, okay, you know, and we'd be at the intergroup meeting, and they'd be looking for somebody to collect the money, or somebody say, oh, Hilda will do that. It's like, okay. So I ended up getting volunteered for everything, and service became really a core of my foundation. And I don't know, I was about 4 or 5 months sober, and she pulled up next to me at the meeting. I got out of the car and I said, you can drive? She goes, yeah, we just had to keep you busy, you know. But, you know, my sobriety hasn't really been textbook sobriety, and I moved from Germany to Belgium and Belgium to England, and I was in England for about 8 years of my sobriety. And, you know, I learned a lot. When we were in England, and I had gone back to school because I thought I wanted to go into a helping profession. I was going to help people. 2.5 years sober, I didn't know myself well enough to know that I don't like people enough to want to do that. But I did go back to university for it. And you know, I truly believe everything happens exactly the way it's supposed to, you know, because I was 6.5 years sober. My mom got diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was in California, and she asked me to come out when she had these operations, and I said I would. And you know, they say, is it odd or is it God? Mm. Oddly enough, because of what I had been doing at university, I got to take my mom home early and nurse her at home, you know. And I was emptying her tubes one day, and my mom turned to me and said, you know, I don't know how I'll ever repay you. And I said, you don't get it. 6.5 years I had waited for that moment, when I got to be the daughter she deserved instead of the one she had. And you know, my mom and I had a great relationship. And I'm really grateful. You know, I always think of that Nancy Reagan interview when Ronald Reagan had passed away. And Nancy Reagan said their whole career, they kept saying, when we retire, we'll be able to look back at all the history we've been part of and all the memories we'll have. And when they got there, he wasn't there. You know, dementia had taken him. And my mom has dementia now. And I am so grateful that I got to be the daughter she deserved while she could appreciate it. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You gave me that. You know, and now we're in a different realm, and I get to be of service in a totally different way. And I'm an only child, so some days I am the greatest thing that ever happened to her, and other days I am the double spawn. But you know, I'm rolling with it. And there are plenty of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are going through the same thing or who have been through something similar, and I know I'm not alone, you know. When COVID happened, our COVID looked a little different than everybody else's COVID. You know, a lot of people hunkered down and stayed home, and Julie and I were both working, and I got a job in Atlanta, and I go to Atlanta 2 weeks a month, and I would go Burbank to Vegas, Vegas to Atlanta, and every time I got on the flight from Vegas to Atlanta, they'd say, okay, there's 60 of us going to Atlanta, spread out, you know, we have the whole plane, and I was in Atlanta working, and I got a call from the La Crescenta Police Department, and my mom had been done for dangerous driving, and they wanted me to come pick her up. And I said, you know, I can't, but my wife can. And I got home the next week, and I went over to my mom's, and she was mortified, mortified that the police had called me. And I said, hang on a minute. It's going to take a long time for those scales to balance for the number of times the police called you on me, you know. And she laughed, and she got it. And a couple of weeks later, she was in the kitchen, and she caught herself being forgetful. And she turned to me, and she said, hang on a minute. I do not want to go to a mental hospital like I put you in. Those are scales I don't want to balance either. No. I thought, wow, she's quick tonight, you know. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I came to a lying, bedwetting whore. The only thing I really wanted to do when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was stay out of trouble. I was really not interested in stopping drinking. I didn't think I really needed to. I just needed to stay out of trouble. But, you know, through strong sponsorship and doing things that rarely make sense, I have been given a life that is beyond anything I could have thought of. And it's not other people's wildest dreams. But it works for me, and it's a happy life that I never thought I would have had. You know, I'm knocking on the door at 60 years of age, and the truth is, I never thought I'd get past 21. You know, in fact, on my 30th birthday, I couldn't get out of bed, because I thought, dear God, I've no retirement, I might get old. You know, but Alcoholics Anonymous gave me all of this, so I went from a lying, bedwetting whore to a good friend, a loving and monogamous wife, and a true daughter to my mother, and for that I thank you. Mm-hmm.
Hilda, thank you so very much. I'm crying inside, guys. Thank you. Bob is going to be our next speaker.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here. My sobriety date is June 3rd, 1992. And I was thinking about what you said, a lot of great things. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I never plan out what I'm going to say. I typically like to roll with it and see what comes out. But, you know, I know that this is a big deal. This is an LGBTQ event at this retreat. And my understanding is that's a big deal for this retreat to have opened up to our community. And so I think my talk's going to be a little bit focused on my alcoholism and who I am and being gay. And I would like to say that my struggles with my sexual identity is the reason that I drink. Like, I would love to be able to blame my alcoholism on being a closeted gay man who couldn't come out. Growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio. But that's not really the truth. I drank because it gave me courage. It gave me friendships. I was always different. I played golf. Like, who plays golf, right? I played golf. I wore polyester pants. Everybody else wore blue jeans. Like, you know, why did I wear polyester pants? I don't know. They all made fun of me. I have a little trans friend who I've been helping lately with life. He's 19 years old. I asked him the other day, he started to transition when he was 13. I said, did the kids in high school give you a tough time? And he looked at me and he said, why would they? Like, because of the people in this room, because of sobriety, because I did grow to embrace who I am, people like him question, why would people have made fun of you? Mm-hmm. Whereas in my world, everybody made fun of me, right? We didn't have any money. I got my jeans at Kmart. I cut the tag out. I didn't want people to know, right? But I drank because when I drank alcohol, I became I became a different person. I became a clown. All the jokes were at my own expense, but I had a host of friends. I started losing my hair. when I was still in high school. And back then, you could buy beer, 3-point-something beer, at 18. And so when I would be 16 or 17, and I could go to the drive-thru, and I was losing a little hair, and they didn't look for an ID, and I could buy beer. And I used that to have friends. Hey, everybody, I'm going to buy beer before we went to the football game. Right? And I used that. And I used it in college, and I was able to be in a fraternity, and I really loved all those things. My sexuality I kept very repressed. And it really wasn't until the last week or two of my college experience that it started bubbling up. And the truth of the matter is, the alcohol saved my life. Like, I think if I didn't have the alcohol and I had to deal with this situation over here, I probably would have killed myself. But the alcohol kept me going, and it kept me moving forward a little bit. Unfortunately, a huge part of my story is suicide, because once I graduated college, and I am a high achiever. I think a lot of us, I worked hard, and I wanted a lot of exterior pats on the back so that I wouldn't feel so terrible about myself. But my world started colliding, and I had a good job in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and there was a park in Pittsburgh. I'm 22 years old. There was a park in Pittsburgh. I would ride my little bike, and lo and behold, there was always a group of guys and people in their cars, and I didn't know what was going on in that park. But I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle me. And there was something in that park I wanted. And I'll never forget the first day I went up to this poor guy, and he's sitting on the hood of his car, and I was like, what's wrong with me? And he's like, he just wanted, you know, like a trick in his car, right? But I was like, no. And he wanted to get away, and I said, no, you got to help me. And anyhow, that was my first gay experience, right? A month later, in that same park on the other side, there was a viaduct over the interstate. And it was a Sunday afternoon, and I stood in that park on that viaduct debating jumping, and I was waiting for the perfect semi-truck to come because I knew I needed a big truck, right, to take me out. And I remember the exact day because that was 1986. It was the first Sunday of April. Jack Nicklaus made the greatest comeback in golf history to win the Masters on that Sunday. And I was a golfer since I was 10. I was a good golfer. I traveled around the country. I played in little golf tournaments. I missed it all because I was trying to figure out whether I was going to die or live. And I continued to drink for 5 or 6 more years. I always moved the geographical cure. If I stayed in any one particular city for too long, you would get to know me and realize that I'm not who and what I portray myself as. So I was always moving. But every time I moved, it was a job up, right? It was like... And anyhow, I wound up in Louisville, Kentucky. I was working in a family business. My life was absolutely terrible. The suicide was just constant. I started missing some days of work or coming in late and manipulating things because of the drinking. And I realized I needed help. So I reached out to my sister, and we found 3 therapists in Louisville, and I called all 3 of them, and only one of them called me back, right? And so that's the one I started seeing. And we talk about divine intervention, or why do things happen the way they happen, and I don't know, but I do believe there's a power greater than me, and if I'm willing to accept it, the stars line up. And this guy, his name was Keith Auerbach. And Keith stuck me in a therapy group, and in that therapy group, there was a guy named Jake. And one day in that group, I was busy telling all of them what they should do and what they shouldn't do. And Jake looked at me, and he said, what about you? I said, what do you mean, what about me? And he said, well, what about you? And Jake called me out. And you need to understand, I'm paying this therapist to see him individually. I'm paying him to go to group. I don't have tons of money, but I'm never being honest, right? I'm only showing the side that I wanted him to see. But Jake, who was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he saw something. He saw through my bullshit. And Jake called me out. And that was the first time I was ever honest with how I drank, how I used alcohol. Like I said, alcohol was my friend. Alcohol wasn't the problem. It was the only thing making everything okay. So I went to my very first AA meeting that night, and I made a commitment to that therapy group that I would go to 10 AA meetings and see how I felt. And by the fourth AA meeting that I went to was an LGBT, that fourth meeting was an LGBT meeting in Louisville. And I walked in there, and me personally, relapse is not a part of my story. I walked into AA and I just knew that that was the answer to so much stuff that was going on in my head. And I couldn't tell you what people were saying. None of it made sense to me. But they were nice to me. And I remember a month or two in going, this one guy took me under his wing and going to a movie. Going to a movie. How hard is that? Right? But for me, I didn't really know how to just go to a movie. David and I went to this movie. And these three lady friends were there, Nina, Wendy, and Laura. And they were there, and they were so excited to see me, and they bought me a bag of popcorn. And they gave me a hug. And all I wanted, with all the men I picked up, with all the everything I did, all I wanted was that hug. Right? But they gave me a hug with nothing wanted in return. And Alcoholics Anonymous worked for me. And because I took to the program, so at 20 months, I did a meeting every day, or tried to do a meeting every single day, because I was so afraid of going back to the life that I had. And I remember one afternoon, Sonny, who was my sponsor, he said, hey, let's go for a bike ride. And I said, I can't go. It was a beautiful fall day in Louisville. And I said, I can't go for a bike ride. I need to go to a meeting. And he said, Bob, it's okay to go for a bike ride with your sponsor instead of going to a meeting. But you see, that's how my brain works. I'm just like, because of all those people, I found the courage to come out. I worked in this family business. We had a factory in Louisville. It's a long story how that happened. I had a brother who politically is very different from me. My everything. But because of recovery, I got the courage to come out. I got the courage to one day realize at about four and a half years sobriety, I got the courage to realize that working in that family environment wasn't healthy for me. And I got the courage to leave. And I had a sponsor at the time. So I left and started my own business. I went into real estate and started my own real estate career. And I had this and I bet everything that I had in the world on myself to start buying real estate. So I'm not as much a realtor as like I own real estate, rental properties. And I bet everything on myself. And I had a sponsor who told me, you know, what's the worst that happens? You fail, right? If you fail, you'll stay sober, you'll file for bankruptcy, and you'll go get a job. And that's the worst that'll happen. But because I had these people in AA, it gave me the courage, you know, to do that. My brother, who thinks very differently than I do on many things, in Kentucky, they were passing a fairness ordinance, which was to give gay people protection in housing and work. And he was circulating a petition against that. And you know, I didn't handle that as sober as I would like to, but I did handle it. I didn't pretend like it wasn't going on, right? I get these strengths and courages from the rooms. Really quickly, my partners, I've been with my husband for 29 years. And the way we met was I had a roommate who I loved, and we would go to the bars all the time. And when I got sober, I realized I couldn't really have him in my house because I just couldn't. It was too hard. So I asked him to leave. And again, I didn't have the tools. I didn't know how to say, hey, I need you to leave nicely like that. I said it a different way. And so then a few years later, it was time for me to make my amends, right? And so I invited him over for a dinner to make amends. And he said, can I bring a friend? And I said, yes, bring a friend. And so the friend that he brought is the person I'm now married to for 29 years. But if the theme is I don't really know how recovery works, I just know that it does. How did I find that therapist? How did I end up in that group with Jake? How did I take to AA? How did I make my amends? And at that particular time, Brent had just moved to Louisville from this little itty-bitty town in Kentucky, and they had met at the gym. And Brent had only been in Louisville for a few weeks. You know, I like to find them young and new, right? So, real to me. But it's an interesting thing with him. We've had a really nice life, but he is a drinker, right? I don't know if he's an alcoholic or not, right? But I know that he's a drinker. Why would my higher power give me a significant other who's a drinker? Why didn't I say, we're done? I can't deal with this. I don't know, but you know what? It has kept me really in the center of the boat. It's introduced me to another fellowship, which has been really, really very helpful to me in my life in learning to keep my focus off of what somebody else is doing and keep the focus on what can Bob do to take care of myself and give me the kind of life that I crave. And the interesting thing about that is the more I take care of me and do the things that I need to do to create the life that I crave, the less crazy the other people seem to be. You know? My day today, I share just a couple other little highlights. I got 4.5 minutes left. 17, 18 years into my sobriety, I'm reading the newspaper one morning and it says, fifth person dies in house fire. And I'm like, oh my God, that's terrible. But turns out it was one of my properties. It was on the national news. They blamed it on me. The long, long short of it is it was a direct result of people doing meth. But it took 8 months for that to straighten out, right? But that morning, before I knew anything and I was crazy, what did I do? I called my sponsor. And I said, Vanessa, here's what's happening. And her answer was, have you done your morning meditation yet? Have you made your bed? Have you taken your shower? Go do those things and call me back. Oh, right? That was a really important lesson. Do the basics. And then by the time I called her back, it let her think about what to do. And then she went with me down to the property. We called the fire marshal. We met. Like, she walked through that whole horrific scenario with me. Right? Gifts of recovery and sobriety. My dad died. And because of sobriety, he and I had a really, really good relationship. My mom, not so much. She's still alive. She's 92. I'm going back to Louisville next week. I've made the decision not to go to Cincinnati to see her because every time I do that, it's terrible on me. And I spend a week or two in the toilet trying to get over. And today I know that they don't have milk at hardware stores, right? So I'm going to go to Cincinnati and take care of the things that I need to, and I will call her like I do every week to be the... I take care of all of her finances. She lives in a senior community. Some people might say that's cruel or terrible. I'll see her in September on my next visit, right? But my dad, he and I are close, and I helped him transition, and I helped him cross over. And that day at his funeral in Cincinnati, there was 12, 15 people from Louisville AA who had come up to help me. And there weren't a whole bunch of people there, but there was all my people there. And my family's like, wow, Like, where are they all from? It's like, they're just my friends who helped me. After Dad died, my cousin invited me to her kid's bar mitzvah in Laguna. We'd never been to California. We went to Laguna. Some friends picked us up and took us to Palm Springs, California. And we came out for Pride in 2019. For Pride was my first exposure to Palm Springs. And we rode into Palm Springs, and I was like, wow. And I believe in the promises where they say we intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. And I was at a point in work and everything else, and it's like, what's next? Where's my life going? What is the next thing for me? And I was never thinking about Palm Springs or California. I came here. We took a couple years. We came and visited. I went to meetings. COVID happened. I think I had some flights. There was five people on that airplane. And we flew out here, and the meeting was at the park. There was a park. I can't remember the name of the park. It was up there. And it was amazing. And I said, I want to go to AA where they have meetings in a park and I can look at the mountains. And Palm Springs Recovery Community has been absolutely great for me. I'm going to close with this. So I have one of my sponsees, who Dustin, I sponsored him in Louisville. He came out a couple times, and he's like, I like Palm Springs, and now he lives here. And we went to a meeting this morning, and we had breakfast, and sitting next to Dustin is his sponsee, John. And he came to breakfast with us. And we were talking about, gosh, there's an awful lot of people out here with 10 and 12 and 15 years of sobriety who are now picking up 60-day chips. Talking about living at Michael's house and what happened. And I said to him, I says, I wonder why our higher power wanted to give us that gift of those people, of their journey and what happened. And it's because I was at a point in my recovery, I needed something new, and I needed to be reminded of what happens to people whose lives get really good, and then they grow away from what got their life really good. And today, I don't want to be that person. And lastly, I'm a chair. Today's my AA day, and I'm chairing some meeting at the Sunny Dunes tonight at 6 o'clock, and the topic is Alone No More. And my little husband, who I struggle with, is going to go to the meeting with me tonight, and not because he needs the meeting, but because he wants to support me in my recovery. And I've waited a really long time to have him go to a meeting with me, and really I owe all of that to you guys. Thank you.
I'm still crying. Thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate it. Next, we have Julia.
Hello. Julia Alcoholic.
Julia.
Thank you for the two speakers. And that Hilda, blimey, what a train wreck she is. Wow. you know, Tommy asked me, I live in Los Angeles, and Tommy asked me to come down and speak, and he said it was the first time you were going to do this, and I'm like, I'm there. And he's like, well, you know, we can't pay for your blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it doesn't matter, Tommy, I'll be over there, and I'll see you later, fine. And as I get older, as, you know, in recovery, it's become, I guess these things have become more quietly important to me. And I felt like it was important to show up. And the longer sober I am, I get an opportunity to show up in a quiet way, which I love. And it for me, you know, they say it's a selfish program. So for me, I'm really grateful for the opportunity just to be able to do that and come along. And my sobriety date is April 16th, 1993. So yes, I am 3 months longer than my wife. FYI, we did not meet sober, and we met sober. We did not meet before that. I think I was like 20 months sober, and she was like whatever the 3 months after that, 16 months sober or something. Then we, and We met at this meeting, and we would secretly call it the Damaged Dykes meeting. And I thought, oh, we've got the Damaged Dykes. We never done that, but it was a lot of fun. But I guess I was thinking about my talk today, and I think I was thinking about, just sitting here, I was thinking about what's been important and what's important to say, I think, for me. And for me, when I got sober, I just want to get out of the way, I'm Irish, the accent is Irish. Yes, I was born in Ireland. People ask me all the time, oh, you have an accent? Yeah, it's Irish. Oh, have you ever been? Yeah. Anyway, you know. So, you know, I really felt like my drinking took off when I was like 10. And I never had no invisible line. There was no invisible line. Like, as soon as I could steal booze, that's probably a clue. That was it. It was on and cracking, and I got sober at 24 and a half. Yes, I know, it's shocking that I'm in my mid-50s. I know. I never really feel like that. I always feel like I'm about 37. I don't know why, but... and then people go up here and talk that are my age, and I'm like, oh my God, do I look that old? I think about... when I got sober, I was living in a convent. I know. And I was going to enter religious life. I felt like I was called to religious life. And I really felt very spiritually called in that way. And but I was living in this community with the Ursuline sisters, you know. And I was going to enter the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary. And so I moved from a hospice I was working at with the Irish Sisters of Charity. And I moved to this place, and they're in the convent, and they put my room is like over the chapel in the house, in the basement, and it was a beautiful room. Like, I come from a very rough and ready background, and everything is secondhand, and you know, one parent family who my mother was drinking and carrying on and involved in a lot of criminal activity, and so we really never had it very much, and nobody was really paying any attention to anything, and so I go into this thing, and it's like beautiful bed and a white sheet that I've never even, like, you know, looked at. I was like, oh. And I was going to get sober this time. I'm a huge cutter when I drink, so I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to hurt myself anymore, and I'm going to get spiritually fit so I can become in the religious community. And I really wanted that, and I really believed it. And 2 days later, I'm so drunk in my new place, back to the convent I go, in and out of blackout, and I smash up the whole beautiful room that they gave me. I had my own lamp and everything, and I smashed up everything. I put my fist through the wardrobe, because that's the kind of alcoholic I am, and I'm coming in and out of blackout, and two of the nuns, are walking me up and down while they're waiting for the doctor to come. And that's how my resolve lasted, like, you know, 36 hours. And so for me, I drank like that for another 9 months there in that house. And really a lot of incomprehensible demoralizations, all that stuff going on. And I have a long history of that. And, you know, I got sober, and my last drink, I was... I'd gone out drinking all day, and I should have been in the religious community working that day. And there was a group of young people coming to the house, you know, for this reconciliation retreat. And I go, apparently I come back at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I've cut myself, and I'm drunk, and I'm in the chapel telling Sister Anne in front of 60 young people what she could do and how she could do it. I guess I was creative. I wake up the next morning, and I'm like, my room is all smashed up, which is fine, but my arms are all ripped up. I don't remember anything. And I'm sick as a dog, and I crawl to the bathroom, and I'm bringing up blood. And I'm at a jumping off place that morning. I make a decision to kill myself. Now, I don't have the language then, but I do now. And Alcoholics Anonymous, we call these moments, you know, the jumping off place. Or we call this... idea, like, you know, life on life's terms. It's terrifying. And I remember so clearly, like it was yesterday, on my knees bringing up blood, thinking, what am I going to do? I can't live with booze and I can't live without it. I'm just going to have to kill myself. Mm-hmm. And that, I'd made my decision. Because the idea of living without booze was terrifying to me. I was very young, you know, very young in myself, and I was frightened. I didn't know any of that, but I knew I didn't like myself, and the world felt very scary to me. And I go upstairs, and there's an Irish guy, and I just met this Irish guy in a Zoom meeting, actually. He goes, "Julie, it's me." I was like, oh, my God. He 12-stepped me, and my arms were all ripped up, and I'm drinking water, and I'd made a decision to kill myself. And he'd said to me, I saw you last evening, and I wonder if you'd like to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I listened to him because he was Irish, because I thought, that's the problem. I'm an Irish woman, and all you British are so anal. You just don't know how to have a good time. And that's what I really believed. But he was Irish. God knew what I needed, I guess. And he was 9 months sober, and he was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. And he 12-stepped me. Imagine, I saw him recently. I was like, it's in this Zoom meeting. I'm like, this guy would be like 32 years sober now. And he was like, Julie, it's me. I was like, oh my God. So I love that, right? So he brought me to my first meeting then. And I can't say that I was like, oh my God, I'm home and I've arrived. But I did think, because it was too crazy, but I did think, I've always known I was alcoholic, always knew I had a problem with booze, always got tight at the wrong time, which was always getting into trouble. I knew, but I just didn't care. Couldn't care less. Why don't you go and mind your own business? And if I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. How about that? That's how it was. And people were like, damn, you know, that gets lonely. I started to go to meetings. And I went to meetings for a good year and a half. And I went to my first AA conference. I think I was probably... Maybe my second year of sobriety, that's right. I turned one in April, and then I went to this conference in October in the south of England. And I wasn't like, I didn't have a sponsor and doing the steps and all that business. I just went to meetings, did fellowship and felt better. That's how I felt, right? And that's how it was. I was slow to warm up. But it was funny because Hilda and I have talked about this, and she was actually at that same conference, and she was living in Belgium at the time. And she came from Belgium to go to that conference, and we, you know, must have passed each other. But anyway, I was in this meeting, and there was a dance going on, right? And I saw these group of women, it looked like they were lesbians. And, I couldn't be sure, but, you know. I could be sure. Now, and they're all dancing, and I suddenly dawned on me, oh my God, I think I'm a lesbian. Right? Like, it dawned on me, because I was so entering religious life, all that stuff, of not giving myself any permission to be anything. And so it really bothered me. So I finally got the courage up. I was downstairs dancing. I hadn't thought about this for years. But I was downstairs dancing with this old guy who was like rubbing up against me. And, I'm like, oh God, I really want to be upstairs with those women. And I was like, oh my God, what does that mean? You know? And so I did. I went upstairs and I asked this woman for her telephone number. She looked like she was the leader of the pack. Probably because she was the butchest woman. I have no idea. And I got her number, and I called her the next day. And here's the amazing piece. And it was terrifying for me because I'm very Catholic. And I love Catholicism. I still love Catholicism. And I, participate in some of that stuff. But it was scary. It was a scary thought for me. And I called her, and it turned out she lived around the corner, literally 5 minutes walk. In this conference, in the south of England, she was like, well, where do you live? And I go, I'm Walthamstow. She goes, where in Walthamstow? I go, at the YMCA. And she goes, oh, I'm actually on the next block. And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. So like, what a God shot, right? So I go over to her, and she starts to introduce me, and she helps me feel not so ashamed, and she helps me not to feel so frightened. And she introduced me to a meeting on a Saturday that I went to, is where I met Hilda, actually. and we were just friends for a long time. But I was so ashamed to go to that meeting. God, I remember walking, it feels so fresh to me, I haven't thought about it for a long time. I remember walking to that meeting in King's Cross, and it was like an LGBT meeting, and I felt so ashamed, and so afraid, and so alone, and I kept wanting to leave, and I couldn't believe I was kind of trying to get sober, and then this was washing over me on top of it. And where is my relationship with God? I'm going to become a nun. And I started to, you know, and they helped me. They people were really kind at that meeting. They brought me out for dinner afterwards. And so I started to force myself to go back to that meeting once a week. But I went to church. I was singing the choir. And I went to church the next day, and I felt so ashamed. I was in the middle of singing, and I left. I left, and I moved away from God for a couple of years. And meanwhile, I got involved in, you know, with my wife and all this stuff. And I just felt like, you know, I think in step 2 or 3 in the 12 and 12, it says, I believed in God, but felt like God didn't believe in me. And that's how I felt for a long time. And I felt very, very lost spiritually because... It was just a pain, but I don't suppose I need to explain it too much. But it was in this group. It was so painful for me, but I started to hit some horrible depression, and I realized that I was spiritually bankrupt, that I didn't have a relationship with God, because I felt like God had moved away from me, and why wouldn't he? Because I wasn't what I was supposed to be. And I was doing all this stuff. Like, what, loving somebody? Anyway, this is how I felt. And so it took me a long time. Depression pushed me back into a place where I started to build a relationship with power greater than myself. And if that only meant like lighting a little candle in the morning, and just every time I tried to pray, I would just sob. Like I'd somehow let God down. It's like, oh, I haven't thought about this for years. It's so, because I'm so different and so comfortable in my life now. But when you look back at that early time, I just felt like I'd let God down. And I felt very alone, and like I said, I started to light a little candle, and I would just sit in the quiet and I'd sob. And then I got like, when I was at Hilda, we went to a convention in Holland, in De Haan, and I'd never travelled anywhere, you know. I'd travel on a bar stool, that's about it. And we went to this convention, and I saw this Buddha statue that was kind of bent over and just in prayer, and it felt like it represented complete surrender and complete humility to me. And so I bought one. So in the morning, I put that next to me candle. And so I'd sit there and I'd just see that. And I started to build that. And then Hilda had a sponsor who was Native American. And she showed me how to smudge. And so I started to find all these little in ways back into a spiritual anchor for myself. I really needed it. And I still need it. I'm still very curious about all this stuff. And, you know, I started to do this smudging. And because it was so different to how I was raised, it gave me an easier access, like the easy route. We just go with the easy route. And that's what I did. I started to build up a spiritual relationship in that way. And, you know, for me, I've worked very hard in my recovery at just... being quiet, because I am wired for sound, and I am quick to anger, right? I'm feisty, I'm like heartbeat, and I've had to work really hard in all these things, and getting spiritually anchored has really helped me with that, to try and live a contemplative life, to move back into a place where I'm quiet a lot of the time. And I work, I have a career, and I'm busy, and I'm in the world. But in the mornings, I try to get quiet, I try to get centered, and it's nothing grand. It's not like I'm a, you know... I did a workshop one time, and somebody meditated, they were like, I was on step 11, and somebody was like, oh, my girlfriend was going to be here tonight, but she just spent 7 hours in meditation, she's so tired, she can't be here tonight. And I'm like, what? And so I've tried... Like what? Like I try to use a relationship with power greater than myself to be useful, to be purposeful. And that has quietened me down. It's given me much more substance in my life. And because of that, I've been able to you know, I work in oncology now, and I built a career for myself. I have my own business, and all that stuff has gone on. But in it all, I feel really grateful to be in a place where I appreciate substance. I appreciate quietness. For my mum, I can't see how much time I have. Can you? Thank you. I don't want to go over. Okay, all right. I haven't gone over. Wow, look at me. 2 minutes. All right. So my from my 50th, I know I told you shocking, but from my 50th, just before my 50th, my mum passed away, right? Suddenly. Massive heart attack. And it really was very difficult because my whole sobriety, I blamed my mum. My whole life I blamed her because she made it easy to blame, if you know what I mean. And I built a lovely relationship with her in my sobriety. And when she died, my siblings asked me to do the eulogy. And I was like, well, why me? I'm the second youngest, you know, a big Irish Catholic family. And I got to do the eulogy. And I got to put my 25-year chip in my mum's hand in the coffin. Mm. And it felt, you know, I gave my mum a big book a couple of times. And she thanked me. And, you know, it's not her. She quotes sometimes. She'd say, well, you know, one drink is... two is not enough, and 100 is too, you know, blah, all this, and I'd be like, what? But she never got it. But when she passed away, I really felt that to my core. Oof, really felt it. And I was turning 50, and my wife was like, what do you want to do for your 50th? And in the morning, I listened to these monks, Benedictine monks of Norcia, small little village outside of Rome, and 2 hours drive outside of Rome. And I listen to these guys in the morning. It really quietens me down. I get really still. And I said to her, I want to be here for my 50th with these guys. Mm. And so we did. And I don't apologize for that. I work for a living, so I can afford it. There was a time I was even at the YMCA and had to take milk out of a meeting because I had no money. It's not what I do now, right? So I went to Rome. We went to Rome together. And we went to Norcia. And on my 50th birthday, we sat in that community listening to the Benedictine monks that I listened to in my morning meditation. I was there in person listening to them. And I really felt my mother so close. And that night we go to a restaurant for dinner, and they're bringing in a cake. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, like mortified. And they start singing happy birthday to me. And in this small little village in the middle of nowhere, me and Hilda ate into the cake, and what was it? It was coffee cake, which is the only dessert my mother would ever eat, was coffee cake. And we started crying. We looked at each other, and we just started crying. What are the chances of that in a small little village in the middle of nowhere? And like these little moments, you know, like in Celtic tradition, we call this a thin place, where heaven and earth just kind of collapse in. And you get a little moment where you're like, it's all right. And I look for those little moments, and I get those little moments in the middle of chaos, in the middle of working, in the middle of all this stuff. I get those thin places. And to me, I've loved being sober, and I've loved developing that kind of experience where, and I still pray for that. I move towards it. And I was listening to a speaker a couple of weeks ago, and they're like, oh, it was a crazy talk, and I always want to be the queen of everything. And I've just discovered in my life, I don't want to be the queen of anything. I just want to be nice and quiet and steady. Quiet and steady. And I want to look for the little thin places, and I want to feel that shift that Carl Jung talks about in our book, you know, the psychic rearrangement. Like a spiritual shift, a shift in my ideas and my attitudes. And I look for those things, and I feel like I'm a very happy customer in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you very much, Julia. Appreciate it. Tissues, anybody? No. Next, we have Frank to speak for us.
Hi. I'll put this up a little. I'm Frank. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Frank.
My sobriety date is June 10th, same as AA's birthday, 1977. So, been sober a long time. And in that time, I've kind of watched my homosexuality, which is quite real, if you don't mind my saying, and my alcoholism, which is real too. I never, ever said to somebody, I have a secret I have to tell you. And if I said to them, I'm gay, every single person I said that to said, we know. So there was a clue right there that I never really thought about. Is it possible that there are things that everybody in the world knows about me and I don't? Well, that sure is a possibility. That's the reason we have our steps. A filter we put these things through. And if we use the filter, what comes out is very different than our ego. So I sort of track both my homosexuality and my alcoholism kind of like this. You know, they go along this way. Unlike so many people that are gay, I was not ashamed of being gay. I don't know why that is, and I'm not saying that everybody else should have been like me, because I got in lots of trouble being very open about it when I was young. So people would say, well, why did you do that? Well, I think I might be a little bit different than the other guys. They kept telling me I was quite different than they were. And it all was quite good in the junior high years, because as you well know, both men and women go through a period of time when experimentation with the same sex is not seen as worthy of being barbecued on a spit for 20 years after you die. So I tried everything. The great horror for me was when all these guys that were available one way or another when I was in junior high, we all got into high school. Guess what? One by one, they peeled off from this side and that side because they were interested in what? Well, they were heterosexual people. It took me a long time to figure all that out. So what I thought I would talk about is, since I sobered up in 1977, I was born in 42, so obviously I'm the same age as Julia. And so what happened was, 37, right? 37. Okay. So what happened was that as I came to sobriety, I came to sobriety from necessity. Something had to be done. By the time I sobered up, I don't even want to go through all this stuff. I'll just give you a little refresher course. At 15, the first time I ever drank at my parents' party, when the people went out in the parking lot, I drank up all the drinks that were left, every single one of them, and then went to the bottle for more. Got very sick. My mother put me to bed, and I was sick, sick, sick. And the next day I woke up and I thought, I think I'm going to die. I had had so much to drink. The very next thought was this: there's got to be a way to make this work. Because the night before, there were adults there that I found interesting. I talked to them. They didn't see my pimples as an adolescent boy, and I was tall and pimply. They didn't see anything except, this guy is a lot of fun to talk to. That was my perception. I'm not sure at all that was their perception, but it seemed to me at the time that that was a very good thing to take a look at. Since then, I've learned to say, it seemed like a very good idea at the time, because I have pulled some awful shit drinking, hurt people. By the time I finished drinking, I had so many DUIs. In the beginning, I could get off. The laws all changed. Then I had three in a row that I was convicted of after those first two. And I had to go to jail. There was just no way they were not going to do that. I was a very good person other than that. I want you to understand it. I want you to be clear on that. But it was a lesson that taught me a lot of things. And when I came into the program, it was a mystery to me because I could not figure out what they were talking about. I had no idea what they were talking about. But when I left, I felt like something was churning within me. Something was happening. Something was changing in me. And I had a few angels along the way. I just want to quickly tell you about some of my angels. My first angel was Ann Whitaker. And she was very much like Hilda in that she was a really talented speaker. Back in those days, the meetings were at 8:30. The meetings went for an hour and a half. There was a break in the middle. And the circuit speakers were really fantastic. That's what we called them. They were both true. They didn't dodge anything. But they made it palatable by making us think human beings who are alcoholic could do these things and not be bad people. It's a real gift. Now, this woman, Ann Whitaker, was a circuit speaker who I seemed to encounter everywhere I went to a night meeting. She was very sought after. And she used to say, "I come from Hollywood and Western, and it ain't the garden spot of the West." And she was a street person. She was very sexual with, I think, anything. And she admitted all these things. And then she said in her talk, "I am so grateful to be sober." Then she gave her whole thing, how she got sober and how she was transformed, actually changed into another woman. And then she said, "What I'm really grateful for is that I am alcoholic." Oh, shit, Louise, what the hell is this? I thought this was like heresy that I should report to the Chancery office. Somebody was saying things that were heretical. So I went to the central office and I said, "I think this speaker needs to be investigated." And you know what they said? "Oh, thank you so much for coming in to tell us what's going on in the meetings in Hollywood." And then I went out the door and I heard this they were all laughing. I thought someone had told a joke. I took myself and somebody who was doing something they shouldn't be doing extremely seriously. So that was Ann Whitaker, and all these years later, lots of years later, I understand exactly what she meant. Because if you are alcoholic, you have to do more to get everything you need. Because we're alcoholic, if we don't, we end up going back. And if we don't go back, it might be worse to be sober a very long time and not have grown. Do we grow into understanding our homosexuality? I hope so. Do we grow in understanding that because we're alcoholic, it doesn't have anything to do with being bad people. So that was my first angel. My second angel was my first sponsor, whose name was Maurice Zolotto. He's dead now. He was a famous author, and he was a writer for all the magazines at the time, the Saturday Evening Post, Life magazine. Of course, you don't remember when that was all there was, but magazines. We got the magazines delivered. We'd sit down and we'd be going through the magazines, finding out. The Saturday Evening Post magazine, Jack Smith's article, 1941, the year before I was born, was the article that put AA on the map. Miracles are happening to people who are alcoholics and get together and talk with each other. We thought that that's the last thing they should be doing. Look at the trouble they can cause one at a time. Why would you ever want to put them together? And Bill Wilson said, get together and show each other exactly who you are. You don't have to hold back anything. So here's the thing. One of the things that's really horrible to have to admit. I heard Maurice Zolotto speak at a Wednesday meeting in Hollywood. And he was erudite. He was educated and so skilled as a writer, and he was famous. He sat at the round table at the Algonquin Hotel with Dorothy Parker and all her drunks. That's why I asked him to be my sponsor. Now, I know. Fool, fool, fool. So he said, meet me at Dolores' restaurant on Santa Monica Boulevard in Santa Monica. So I went there. I thought he was going to talk about his fame for writing the definitive biography of Marilyn Monroe. He didn't mention that ever, as long as I knew him. He said, let's figure out which meetings you're going to be going to. And then he said, you must go every day or you'll soon be drunk again. Mm-hmm. Call me, but not before such and such a time in the morning. And be at the yard on Saturday to play ball. Did I have any idea this was a rabidly heterosexual group of alcoholics who were getting sober just fine? It was a Pacific group. So I went out there, I had to play ball. My father even said, he throws like a girl. This was not the thing that I had planned and hoped for in my life. And I used to just, they put me in right field. Well, first I was as a pointer. You had to point at the dog poop. That was your service commitment. So Hilda's complaints meant nothing to me. She has no idea what I went through. I had to go to the yard and point at the poop. And then the scoopers came and they scoop it up. And then eventually they could play ball. Well, then one of the great glories of my early sobriety was I was promoted to a scooper. And I was so into the group, I was calling everybody, guess what? I got promoted to a scooper. And some of them said, are you still gay? Are you sober? So then I got to play in right field. And when I was out in right field, I just learned to pray. I know there's different ways of learning to pray, some in church, some in synagogue. I learned in right field. Please, God, if you created me, if you have any mercy for me, do not let that ball come into this area. And one time, I saw that it definitely was coming my way, which of course destroyed all belief in a higher power for at least a while. But I put the glove up and I just closed my eyes. And I put the glove up like this. Wouldn't you know, went right into the glove. Those rabid ruffians stopped the game, came and picked me up and carried me around the bases. That's the reason I'm here today. So, anyway, that was my... Now, you know, his famous saying to me, as smart and famous and drunk and everything that he was, he used to say to me, Frank, blame is useless. He was teaching me step four. Anytime you have an indignation, says it right in the book, we just go over it pretending it's not there. Anytime you have an indignation, oh, this is how much I have left. Oh, that much left, okay. Where was I? Indignation, we all know about that. It's a boomerang. If you get angry and you're indignant and you blame somebody, it always goes right around the other person, comes right back and hits you right in the head. You don't have to believe that. Just keep noticing what happens when your indignation is never dealt with. My next angel was Jeremiah. Got to tell you this fast. Jeremiah was at Harbor Lights down on Skid Row. He was an old black guy with no teeth. And Maurice told me if anybody asked me to sponsor them, I should say yes. And I said, I couldn't do it. What if I give somebody bad advice and they die? I'd be a murderer. He said, you need to start this very soon. So Jeremiah, for the first time in his entire life, got sober. And then, one awful day, he went out and got very, very drunk, and he got hurt and beat up and everything. And he came back and he said, can you help me again? And I said, you know, I put my all into it, and maybe you should ask somebody else. And he said, no, please help me. I said, why would it be different this time? I mean, I'm willing, but just tell me, why would... And I can hear it in my ears. He said, he had a very low voice, but forgive me, I can't go very low. Said, as sweetly teachable. That's why. And I've never forgotten. When we know everything, it's very hard to learn anything. As sweetly teachable. My last one was my second sponsor, who was Father Terry. He was a priest in L.A., and he was both active in AA and in Al-Anon. So the first time we went out, after he agreed to sponsor me, I had a list of things I wanted him to cure and solve and take care of. So we were having lunch there on Wilshire Boulevard, and I went through the whole list. And I want you to understand, these were very serious items. Took myself extremely seriously. So when I got through all of them, he said, you know, Frank, it's lovely having lunch with you, but I need your expertise. I want to get a recording of the Debussy piano music, and would you let me know of the best recording? And I thought, am I in another world? Does he not see how needy I am? It was his way of simply saying, you have to be responsible for your own work. Take care of your tasks. Let your motto be, is it up yet? Oh, oh, 5, 4, 3, 2, all right, let me hurry up. And he said, so what I realized was my motto from here and now is this. What should I do from here on? Because we're at the brink of anything we choose to be at the brink of. What should I do from here on? Thank you.
So bad.